Into the final moments, Alex Payne trying to keep this side going forward. Haskell takes it on now with just relentless chat, largely about himself. And there's Tindall to add the finishing touch of glamour and World Cup winning stories and a slightly sideways nose. That is how you podcast. A dominant display by the good, the bad and the rugby.
Hello, Dream Team. How very nice to be back with you once again as the good, the bad and the rugby. This is season 3, episode 2, would you believe? Hask and Tins are here. And this week, for the first time, we cut the ribbon. We should actually have an official opening of our new studio, which isn't going to mean a lot to the pod listeners, but will mean a lot to those of you on YouTube. For those who are audio only, would you like to describe our new surroundings and why we've moved here?
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Some sofas, a bit more space, not trapped behind a booth. Some lovely mementos of the memories we've made together.
We have.
some have been... Jesus, you're right.
Try to remember them. CPR machine and a first aid kit. Oh my God. What I was about to say is the lovely thing about the new studio is we have microphones that we can take away, which we don't...
The old lungmongous tobacco-tastic over here.
But unfortunately, he's just broken the first one already with his...
The sound guy's ears have burst as he's coughed and heavy breathed through it. It is very nice. Got some new lights, big screen. As I said, memorabilia from some memories. Some have been redacted. Couldn't possibly put them up.
They're on the other side of the cameras.
Against 2022. Otherwise, it's very nice to be here. I mean, we did have an extensive table.
Yeah.
And they've replaced it with what, look, I mean, I don't know what the fuck this is, but it's sort of a miniature stool, but actually it's quite nice because apparently it drew away from the eye.
Well, it could be now it's like fuck Shira now.
Exactly. Shira, she's come a long way.
Shira.
She's been involved for long enough.
A weight around in the mix and telling us what to do.
And also,
you know,
it's very,
what happens
to
those people.
Yeah, you know, because obviously you could say it'd be misogynist if we were to do that. But equal rights. So we used to give Si shit. Shire is getting shit now. So that's how we treat everyone equal. That's what's important, isn't it?
Si and Shy.
Si and Shy. Both shy. I'm joking. Now we've got these lovely sofas. There's some hospital waiting room that's missing them, which is quite nice.
Struggles.
It is struggle. We've got mugs.
We've got mugs.
We've got a couple of them over here. And we've always got these. So I'm very excited. Yeah. And it should look better. If you go onto our social media, at James Haskell, Mike Tindall, Alex Payne TV, and obviously give us a follow on the Good Bad Rugby channels on Facebook, on YouTube, on TikTok, and where else?
Twitch.
Grind. Calm down, you're not up with the kids. I love he's just throwing arbitrary words out there. Twitch, Snapchat. Bebo, MySpace.
MySpace and Face, my Face and Facebook, or whatever it's called.
Space. But no, but otherwise we're good, aren't we? New studio, new season. You know,
I think we are very excited. I mean, I would describe this as a little bit like the glitter on the turd. I mean, a new studio, I'm not quite sure what it's going to do for the quality of the content. I think for those of you who are listening, you've probably fast-forwarded through the last 50 seconds of this.
And what the listeners can't see is now the extensive team we've got.
We have got a big team.
You know, like the more you progress in 2022 in the content creation world, the more people you need. I'm not sure what, I would say, I can see what one person's doing. I'd say at least four of them have got fucking no idea why they're here. We've got a multimedia social manager out there. We've got an MD. We've got an account. We've got people coming out the woodwork to suckle at the GBRT.
What a particularly unpleasant concept that is.
Tuned in and not being sick right now. Welcome to the Good, the Bad, the Rugby.
The band is back together. We're off and running in our very smart new studio. We have got a very smart new guest. Don't flick the bird.
You've actually just done that to all the YouTube.
HR.
The YouTube people.
Not bothered.
Before we get our very esteemed guest on, more on that in just a moment, quick word on the World Cup, which finally, God, it feels like we've been building up to this in New Zealand for a long time, given, of course, it was meant to be played last year, but wasn't because of COVID. The cover's finally come off. The Rugby World Cup 2021, this Saturday, Rita Ora performing, I think, in Auckland. Oh, nice.
Married to
He was at the Bledisloe Cup.
Taika
Waititi.
What a great actor.
He was at the Bledisloe game
director.
Last weekend.
I really like him. I'm a massive fan of him. Love his voice.
England's to lose?
I think so, yeah. I know that New Zealand have turned a few corners over the past few months. Obviously, they had that massive change.
Sorry, they haven't turned a corner. They've employed they've got every single ex All Black person or anyone in the history. Dan Carter doing the kicking.
Well, Rich McCord and today actually hasn't had a little bit to do.
I mean, everybody's been. I mean, it's amazing going from they couldn't win. Well, they were winning. They were the number one team. Then they got soundly beaten by England. I was at those two games, and then to sort of had that transformation. They then got. Your man in the...
Wayne Smith. Dan Carter's done some stuff.
Wayne Smith, Rich McCourt, Dan Carter. I think Kevin Mialamu's been in.
Has he?
Yeah, I think everybody's been in and a real effort to make sure this home game...
You throw your mind back to 2011 and what the pressure was when they had to win in a home World Cup. I think it's no different this autumn. They will have been hurt from when they travelled over earlier on this year. England are just in such... They're leading the way in terms of how, professionalism, in terms of how they run the club game. So it is theirs to lose. But the good thing is with our girls is they never take that for granted, even though they know put 70 on someone. But they keep putting in those performances and they'll have to do that. I mean, it's not going to be easy for them, but I would expect them to come away and win that.
Hug for Mo.
Yes.
One of our crew. And I might send her a message saying, sorry, it's been a shit day. Keep thinking, remember Stephen Donald in 2011. You never know where the call might come, when you might be needed to go and win a World Cup.
Especially if you know, as the girls are trying to get to the airport and an unmarked car comes racing out of nowhere and runs over the other two nines. these things can happen. Yeah. But no, it's very sad that she's not there. But means that she will be able to do some more stuff with Good Scales Rugby.
Yes, we'll do some bits and bobs. Will you be watching? It's an early start, but how much of it will you...
It'll be a catch-up thing. I will try and watch all the games because I think it's important, and I think it's still going to be fascinating. There's still massive amounts of improvement to come from so many teams. Obviously, you know, the teams that have taken up partial contract, Wales, how are they going to fare in that? Obviously, I know that England sort of put them to the sword a little bit in the warm-up games. But
they've got a new sponsor, Vodafone's doing some good stuff for Wales.
So, and they've committed to sort of trying to drive that forward. So I think there's interesting stories to come beyond this World Cup, but also during it.
Well, I hope for a tighter pack all round.
I think as well, France, you know, we talked about New Zealand, France, ultimately for a long period of time in that Six Nations have been the main competition for
and
England.
And if you then throw into that how much of an up, lift it will give France ahead of next year if the girls can go and win out there, and then you're bringing it home, first game of the World Cup in just under 355 days or something, is France versus New Zealand.
Good luck to Simon Middleton, to Sarah Hunter, and to our very own Skaz as well. Quick check on the times and places. I'd be impressed if you are setting the alarm for 2:15 as South Africa take on France. Fiji against England.
Perfect if you're having a big night.
Perfect if you're coming in, absolutely. Fiji against England at 4:45 and Australia take on the Black Ferns on home soil at a slightly more respectable time of 7:15. We'll definitely be watching that one. England's games are Fiji Saturday the 8th, obviously coming up. France Saturday the 15th, that is one to ring in red. And South Africa on Sunday the 23rd before we head towards the knockouts. Let's move on because we've got a proper goodie on the show this week. You've been waiting to talk to him for a long old time on The Good, the Bad and the Rugby. He is somebody who's been there and done. It's actually quite hard to know where to start when you're trying to introduce him. He's a three-time Premiership winner, a Heineken Cup winner. He's got four Six Nations titles, three of which were Grand Slams. He made it to two World Cup semi-finals and top it off, he has won one, drawn one and unfortunately lost one with the Lions as well. All of that he's done as a coach. As a player, of course, he was an All Black and one of the greats of Waikato rugby. Need I say much more? Ladies and gentlemen, it's the one and only Warren Gatland. Could we bring him in, please, from the other side of the world? Warren G, first things first. How are you? Where are you? We've got a lot of fancy artwork in the background. Set the scene for us. What time is it with you and where are you right now?
And also, can I ask a question? Have you ever listened to Warren G?
No, I haven't.
Oh.
No, you haven't.
No. I think
we're right up your alley. A bit of Regulate.
But Jeff Strange named his boat Warren G. There you go, James.
Right, called it Warren G. Unbelievable. Hey, what are you doing Monday night? Fancy a game?
Set the scene for us, Warren. Where are you and what time is it and how are you in life right now?
It's just after 9 o'clock in the evening, Monday evening, at home. Yeah, we're kind of at the moment just in the off-season watching matches, watching the NPC, keeping a bit of an eye on the Premiership as well and the Championship, the United Rugby Championship. And we're probably in the office sort of two or three days a week, just sort of planning really for next year's Super Rugby competition.
Good on you. We are genuinely incredibly excited to have you on. There are a few characters in the sport right now who have got as many stories to tell and as many chapters to what they've done over the last few years. The question I sort of want to start with is, where are you right now with rugby? You've obviously, you know, you've got a lot going on, but are you somebody who is... I mean, Eddie Jones often talks about wanting to get to the beach and go and watch cricket. Are you ready to have a cigar on the porch and enjoy the sunset? Or are you someone whose fires are burning as brightly as they always have done?
Oh, and I think the fires are burning. It was actually interesting because I'd had come back from Wales, had gone into the Chiefs, and then obviously with COVID and everything, and then had the year away with the Lions, and Clayton McMillan came in as head coach, did a really good job when I came back, and I just said, look, why don't just carry on with Clayton doing it? And I was prepared to walk away, actually, and just do something else. I wasn't worrying. They said, no, we want you to stay on board. So I'm director of rugby, really sort of working with the coaches closely, probably a little bit more hands-on than normally. And so day-to-day stuff and really enjoying that. I'm contracted not actually to the Chiefs but to the New Zealand Rugby Union, and then my contract's up next year, and, you know, whether I re-sign with them or whether I look for something else, I'm sort of contemplating that at the moment.
What is it that flicks your switches about, obviously, winning everything that you've won as a coach? You've pretty much covered the whole board. What do you need out of a season or out of a stint at a club or a country that really gets you inside, that makes you passionate about what you're doing?
I look at success not always as winning. I look at success as overachieving. And, you know, I think the football premiership's probably the best example. You know, you get the top teams that have the most money and the best players are always going to finish the top of the table. But you get some teams that get promoted or haven't had great seasons in the past and sort of finish in the top half of the table. And to me, that's been successful. And so any environment that I've gone into, any team that I've gone into, I kind of look at that as the starting point. You know, what's the expectations here? And let's beat those expectations or, you know, hopefully overachieve. And that's, you know, dealing with the cattle that you've got to work with to start with. And then, you know, hopefully putting in place structures, creating an environment where, first of all, people are enjoying themselves, but they're working hard and they want to be there. And if you can do that and you can have a bit of fun, you can get the balance right between working hard and also enjoying yourself, you know, and like I said, you know, about creating that right environment, then hopefully you've got a chance of being successful. And that kind of what drives me. I love going into with teams and environments and trying to create something that people want to be a part of.
Gats, has that always been the way you thought? Because I was lucky enough to interview Eddie Jones, and he said kind of when he started his career, he was win at all costs. It was win at all costs. That's what he cared. And he almost cared too much about that. Now, you've obviously had a lot of success and, you know, you've been around the game a long time. Has your philosophy developed to what you just said now? Or have you always been quite pragmatic in that respect? And it was much more about the journey than it was about the results.
Yeah. Look, I don't know. I think you change over time. You learn. You know, I've got an insatiable appetite for knowledge. I don't know everything about the game. There's a hell of a lot I don't know about the game. And so, you know, trying to learn, you know, as much as I can and listening to people, I love debating and having discussions about the game and where it's going. And I think my philosophy at the moment is kind of I go into an environment and I always talk about how lucky we are to be doing what we're doing and playing professional sport and getting paid for it and stuff. But to me, the most important thing an environment's your family. And people look at me and say, what do you mean by your family? And I found that to be incredibly powerful as a coach, and say, you know, whatever's going on at home, if there's any issues, any problems, you know, come to us. We can help you out, sort you out. If players need some time off, some family time, you know, I'm always able to do that and deliver that for them, because I kind of feel if things are right at home, then I get a better product at trainings and better product at the team. So it goes hand in hand about just, you know, family comes first, rugby comes second. And that's kind of always been one of my, you know, philosophies about it. It hasn't always been about winning, but it's about working hard. And I think as a coach, one of the things that I promised myself when I went into coaching was to never coach the things that you didn't like as a player. I mean, I hated long training sessions. They used to drive me, you know, nuts and that. So I wanted, and but if someone asked me to train for a, you know, 45, 50 minutes and go as hard as I could for 45 minutes, and then I would do that. But if someone said, you know, it's a 2-hour training session, I struggle with those sorts of things, you know, long training sessions where you got a little bit bored, where you're holding back a little bit because you can't go hard for, you know, in terms of pushing yourself for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And And I think that's kind of been, I've sort of hung my hat on that over the years. I've had teams that have worked incredibly hard. We've been fit. Like I said, we've had some fun on and off the field. We've enjoyed ourselves. And like I said, families come first.
I can think of someone else around here with a relatively short attention span who needs things to be kept at four minutes, you, rather than 45.
Absolutely. I was spoiled. See, now all these teams that I've played for subsequently, you know, all adopt essentially the Warren Gatland and Craig White methodology of short, sharp, purposeful training. You know, you'd go in and work with Gats, and it would be, you know, Craig White would be on the side with a stopwatch. And it would be shouting. It was the first time I'd ever seen it. When you got, you know, Warren Gatland be shouting at my Craig White, Warren, you know, you're running over. Warren, go right. Could you take 2 minutes off the contact? Add a minute to the you know the exit plays, and it would be done like that, and it would be meticulous. And I remember Lawrence
barter system.
Yeah, but you have a framework, and you could lose some minutes here. And I remember, you know, Gats would say it a lot. Lawrence would start a lot of training sessions going, listen, lads, you know, we're being asked to do 45 minutes of work here. You know, what other job in the world do you get paid to do this? Do it well, execute it fast, execute it sensibly. And then that means that also there's very limited margin of error. So when someone does fuck up, then they're made accountable, and then you suddenly breed that accountability. It's actually a really good way of doing it, as opposed to long drawn out things where mistakes just happen and everyone goes, oh, don't worry about it, carry on. It's like you've got one play to execute it, one play to finish it, which you may only have in a game, England versus Wales, you've got one minute to score a try, get it right. So it's a really
interesting thing. We used to have one with Dean Ryan called Blue Sky Thinking. He's like, if you go as hard as you can, this will be a short session. 2.5 hours later, you've all pulled back. We've tried as best as we can. Yeah, but you didn't get it right. Okay.
Yeah, Die Young had the same system where he'd be like, listen, lads, I'm not being funny, but you know, and then because you used to wear the GPS vests,
yeah.
They used to go, look, we're only doing 45 minutes, and the GPS, and I put my hand up, and they're like, yes. And I went, it's not 45 minutes. I went, he goes, yes, it is. I went, does it include the warm-up? No. Does it include the extra forwards units afterwards? No. Does it include scrums? No. It's a 2-hour session. You're talking shit. You're talking shit. They were like that. James, can you listen? You're one of the senior players. We don't need you in undermining everything. I was like, but don't say it's 45 minutes when it's 2 hours. Disguised. It's rebranded for 2022.
Have you taken quite a lot of pride, Warren, in watching your methodology spread out across the game in the way that it has?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, particularly that time at Wasps, it was incredibly successful, and then a lot of teams adopted the things that we did from a training perspective in the gym, and obviously what we did on the field. Probably as an ex-teacher, you know, I don't like meetings and lots of meetings and long meetings as well. You want to be short and sharp, and you know, I suppose I really hang my hat on them now. And the way that, you know, for trainings, you know, how do you make training's harder than it is in the game? And so, you know, particularly with Wales, in fairness to those boys, they train their butts off. They worked incredibly hard. They never questioned. They never complained. But it was kind of, how do you replicate what happens at test match level? Because you guys know that you play club level and then you go up to international, and the step up is massive in terms of pace and the intensity and the physicality. And so, how do you replicate that at trainings? And so I do things like working with the fitness trainers. We had, you know, with Craig White and then Paul Stridgen, who's absolutely fantastic as well. And so you might do a six-minute block of attack, and then you might go over to Paul Stridgen and do 4 or 5 minutes of conditioning work where the players are in absolute fatigue, and then you go and do another block of, you know, where it could be attack or defence, and the guys are in fatigue, and so you're really pushing them to the limit where they're performing their skills under pressure, under fatigue, and it's probably, you know, sometimes harder than it is in a match. And if you can get that right at training, and you can start, the first thing that goes is the voice. When you get tired, you stop talking, you stop communicating, so I'm always on to the players. You've got to keep the voice. You've got to keep your communication. You've got to make a noise. And then, you know, when you're really blowing, you know, really focusing and concentrating on executing those skills in small blocks. And it's always about, you know, doing the hard work, doing the hard shit first, you know, do the hard work. And if you work hard when you're really under fatigue, and you know, it's a lot easier than switching off and then all of a sudden having to run 60 metres back because someone's made a break and you're behind your goal line and someone scored. You know, you'd rather do the hard work and stop something at source. And when the whistle goes, that's when you get your time and your breathing, you know, to get your breath back. And you know, that's kind of been what I've really, really focused on in terms of those training sessions, you know, mixing it up. But short, sharp blocks of focusing have been really, really intensive.
I love listening to coaching philosophy, particularly off the back of all the success you've had. What I'd love to do, I want to talk about you as a player and the early part of your career and obviously working with Hask and Wales and Lions, etc., and come back to that. I'd just love to pick up on what we were talking about at the start, because actually before we started recording, you said you've just become a granddad and you've got a little one now, 11 months old. Yeah, I know when you went back to New Zealand, there was a sort of a call of home. Are you settled there now and whatever comes next will be there? Or when you mention the Prem and URC, is that just cleverly saying, I potentially could saddle the horse and go again? I mean, where would you love to be for the next chapter of your career?
Oh, look, I don't know. I've never had a rugby agent in terms of job. I've always been a great believer in what will be and something will come along. And I've been, you know, incredibly lucky in that. I don't have a CV. You know, I've never applied for a job. You know, someone's sort of come knocking or knocked on my door and said, would you be interested? So
your Wikipedia page probably does it for you, actually.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, you know, like I said, my contract's up with New Zealand next year and I'm not actively looking for something, but, you know, if the right thing comes along, then, you know, I'll have a look at something.
What would be the right thing? Who would you love to, whose number would you love to see flash up on the mobile?
I haven't even gone that way. You know, it could be back in the Premiership. It could be in France. There's opportunities in Japan as well. It could be waiting until after the World Cup and, you know, maybe it's international rugby again. I'm not actively looking, but something will come along and it'll be the right thing at the right time.
I think Twickenham is 0208. Well, it'll be 0044-0208. Have you got that number in your mobile? So the question is, would you ever be interested in England? I know there's been a bit of hype and speculation before, but as you sit here now, post-World Cup, would you do it?
Look, that's a long way down the road, and I don't think I'd be allowed back over. Well, they wouldn't let me back into Wales if I went and took on the enemy. So, look, I love my time there in Wales, and but look, you never say never about anything, and like I said, we'll see what happens over the next few months.
Basically, that you can interpret that as cash talks.
Yeah, that does indeed. That you've also learned well.
Yeah, you've taught Hask well on that one as well, Gats, to be fair. Yeah.
What burns bright? Yeah. When I need an extension on the house and a new car or something.
Yeah. You know, I remember having a conversation. I was in Hong Kong one time. And they said, oh, would you be interested in coming to coach Hong Kong? And I thought, oh, what am I going to say here? I said, look, I don't mean to be rude, but I don't think you could afford me. And they turned around and said, we've got $150 million in the bank. I went, oh, okay.
That should get you through one season, guys, shouldn't it? Yeah, the thing is, I think they might, you know, they probably won't have you over the Severn Bridge again because you've emptied the WRU. You're done with them now.
Tell me about when rugby became the thing for you, because you were a Waikato legend. I think we see it every time the Lions rolls around, particularly in New Zealand. Your solo effort for Waikato against the Lions in 1992. It was a 5-yard trundle, just for those of you who don't remember it. But obviously, you know, you were a Waikato legend. You played for the All Blacks. You had a great tussle with Fitzy for so many years. How do you reflect on your playing career and how that's potentially influenced what you've gone on to achieve in the game?
I think I look on probably three coaches that had a huge influence on me. One was Alex Wiley with the All Blacks, and probably, you know, he trained us incredibly hard. He pushed us probably harder than you'd expect, or harder than anything. I was really, really disappointed in my first game for the All Blacks. We played in Perth against Western Australia, and he'd trained the crap out of us all week, and I remember waking up on the morning for my first All Black game, you know, really excited, but my hamstrings were tight and I was sore from training. We went out and won the game by 60 points, but, you know, just it was one of those games where afterwards you just – I wasn't as fresh as I could have been because he'd pushed us so hard during the week. But, you know, there was method in his madness because, you know, he'd work us hard and then come to test weeks, he'd freshen us up. And so I probably, you know, from him I learned that there. Glenn Ross, who'd coached me at First 15 and at club and for Waikato, was an ex-school teacher and incredibly structured and organised in the way that he ran his training sessions, you know, in terms of timings and drills and said, you know, this is the session. He'd planned it out and the times that would take. So I took a huge amount from him. And then another guy who was an All Black and played a lot of games for Waikato was a guy called Kevin Green, who probably technically not the greatest coach in the world, but for me it was his man management skills. You know, and so, you know, he was incredibly good at getting the best out of players and getting them up for games and creating a really positive environment within a team. So I've tried to take the best out of those three guys as coaches and then add my own sort of personality, you know, into that. I was at a school function last week. They had a fundraising for my old school, Hamilton Boys High School, but I was looking through an old school report card and it said, one of the teachers wrote on it, "Warren, life is not a sports field."
Turns out it is.
How wrong he was, really. So, yeah.
And what about the relationship with Sean Fitzpatrick, who played 92 times for the All Blacks, probably walks into most World 15s in the history of the game. And I think in the past has said that he played on in test matches with arms falling off and head split open and knees that were sort of facing the wrong way solely because that meant you wouldn't get on. And I'd just love to know now whether you see him, whether it's a nod, it's a handshake, or a hug. How do you reflect on a relationship with Sean?
In the face.
Or a punch in the face.
Or you run over in the car.
Or a hacker, I don't know.
Oh, no. A lot of people have asked me that question, and I look back at it and go, look, I'm incredibly proud of the time that I had in the All Blacks and, you know, 4 years. And like I said, I don't know how many times I sat on the bench to Fitzy and never got on because, you know, but I've got a huge amount of them. Admiration for him in terms of what he achieved in the game and incredibly tough opponent. But I was probably a hooker that played and won against him more than any other hooker in the history of the game because, you know, whether that was playing for Waikato against Auckland or an All Black Trials where, you know, I was on the winning side. And I reflect back on that time and I think it's made me, for the time that I'd spent on the bench and not playing, I think definitely made me a better coach in understanding what players who miss out on selection and what they go through and how disappointed that they are. And I looked at it and go, you know, look, you miss out, but then you've got a responsibility then to the team to do the best that you can in terms of preparing yourself but also helping prepare the team for a test match. And and I think that a lot of players don't realise sometimes that coaches might not say it or they might not mention to you, but you get someone in your squad who's, you know, on the bench and hasn't quite made it. I expect them to be disappointed. I expect them to be really disappointed about not being in the team, but it's then how they respond to that disappointment, you know, how they respond in the team and not throw the toys out of the cot, you know, not be despondent. Yeah, you've got to put that disappointment behind you and you've got to move on because that's life and that's sport. And often those are the guys that you find that they get rewarded because they're the people that you want in your squad, they're the people you want to be a part of the environment that you're trying to create. And I think that experience, you know, those disappointments in terms of, you know, not getting on in a test match or missing out, you know, definitely I think it's made me a better coach from those experiences.
just reading between the lines there on your answer, I think basically said you beat him in every time every game you played, you beat him in every trial. Basically, you were a better player, but if it wasn't down to politics and poor coaching, you would have started. That's what I'm reading.
He knows where the bodies were buried.
That's what I'm hearing. Is that true?
No, but the thing is,
it's like every man you've got to believe in a pub, isn't it?
You've got to believe in yourself. You've got to believe that you're a better player. You've got to believe that if you get the opportunity, you can do the job. Otherwise, you shouldn't be there. It doesn't mean you don't have admiration or respect for the person who's ahead of you. That's understandable. But you've got to have that confidence and belief in yourself that if that opportunity comes around, that you want to take it and that you can do a good job. I can remember sitting in an All Black bus and looking out the window, and there'd be hundreds of people around the bus, and just saying to myself, you know, just don't take this for granted. You know, how lucky you are and how privileged you are to be where you are sitting, and you know what you've achieved in the game.
I think I know the answer to this, but I wondered, part of the reason you've been so successful with your coaching career and kind of dedicated, had such passion, was because perhaps you didn't get as many opportunities as you wanted for whatever reason. But obviously, from what you've talked about, you believed in yourself, you know, you maintain your standards, and you were a key part to that All Black machine. Is part of the reason you've been so successful that drive to kind of, you know, to prove yourself again and to show, do you know what, it might not have happened as much as I want on the field, but by God, I'm gonna be one of the best coaches in the world?
I think there's a part of that. There's also that sometimes I've seen the best players and the most naturally gifted players, they don't understand why they are good. That it's just natural, it just comes to them. But so, you know, when you've got to work and you're fighting hard for your position, then you're probably a little bit more self-analytical, and you're sort of kind of asking yourself questions, you know, what can I do? Where can I get better? That's definitely from a coaching perspective has driven me, you know, to want to be successful with regard to that. You know, definitely those experiences have added to that probably understanding, really, of a whole team environment. And you know what it's like. You guys know. I mean, it's the hardest thing. I always find the hardest thing in coaching is, you know, in selection and when players miss out and when players have been who are disappointed, because not everyone's going to be happy within a squad, and you're going to get players who are going to be, you know, disappointed with the lack of opportunity that they've had, and you like to think that they have that confidence and belief that if they do get that chance that they're good enough to take it, but it doesn't always happen, and not every player, the unfortunate thing in professional sport is not every player gets treated the same. It's just it's the way it is. It's kind of like some players that you'll make a decision on selection on early in the week because you've got two players in the same position. It's a 50-50 call, and then someone else you might give to a Thursday or Friday before you make a call on that because, you know, they're pretty important to the squad. So, but if people understand that and you point those things out and you're up front and you're honest, and that's, you know, one of the things I've tried to be as much as I can is be as honest. I won't bullshit anyone. You know, I'll try and, you know, be up front. And I think that, but one of the things I've probably learned a little bit watching the last couple of months, or thinking about probably looking at the All Blacks and probably going through a little bit of a period where it's been a little bit up and down, I've kind of felt that probably one of the success that I have is that as a coach, every now and again you've got to have a bit of mongrel. You know, you've got to have that ability to point the finger and circle the wagons and look someone right between the eyes and just tell them, you know, either that's not good enough, or that's not good enough, or at halftime or before a game, because that's what winning's all about, and that's what professional sports are all about. You've got to sometimes, you know, it's not just about being nice. Sometimes you've got to find something, you know, whether it's losing your temper, which you can't do very often, but if it's once or twice a year, it might be enough. But you've got to be able to change things up and have an impact. And that's what I say about, you know, just having a bit of that mongrel where you're showing the players how much it means to you and how desperate you are to want to perform and want to win. And
do you think the All Blacks have been missing that this season?
Possibly. Yeah, possibly.
But or is it deeper than that? I was thinking, you know, I think everyone seems to think that building a team that consistently can stay at the top. I know it's expected of New Zealand to be able to do that. But do you think that's actually all the other countries around the world with the sharing of coaching that it is now in terms of New Zealand coaches coming over around the world, South Africans all around the world, that the standard of everyone else, you're always chasing number one. So everyone was always chasing what the All Blacks wanted to be. And since, you know, sort of 2015, when they lost that huge spine, everyone seems to think it's just an ongoing sort of wagon that just keeps rolling. It's not, though, is it? When you can lose that many, sort of, you talk about the spine of the team that was in that New Zealand sort of 2015, who went through that the heartbreak of the 2007 World Cup. It sometimes takes that period to bring up the point of what you said, get that mongrel back, because you need to start showing it if you're going to get back to those levels. Do you find that that's what they're going through at the moment, the New Zealand team?
Oh, yeah, I think there's a little bit of that. I think that probably from 2015, they probably sat on their laurels a little bit. You mean, if you go World Cup in 2019 when they lost to England, I was watching that and thinking, you know, I think England had something like 30 set piece starters in the game. I mean, why, when you play England, do you want to give them 30 set piece starts? So, you know, that's, and I think the criticism that I would have had is that because they've had so much success over the years, everything was, we look inwardly, this is our systems, this is our structures, we believe in that, we trust that. And I think it's caught up with them. And I know when I came back from Wales after 2019, and a lot of the stuff, you know, in New Zealand rugby is really good and really positive. But there's some really good things happening outside of New Zealand, and a lot of good things happening in the Northern Hemisphere. And to try and introduce that was quite challenging at times, because the players would look at you and go, "Oh no, that's not how we do it. We do it differently. Yeah, this is how we do it over here." And so I think actually, ironically, that the best thing that for New Zealand rugby is actually that the All Blacks having a little bit of a slump, because now they're looking outwardly, they're looking at what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere and not relying on what they've traditionally done in the past, and just focus on themselves. And I had a coffee with Felipe Contepone after Argentina had beaten the All Blacks, and he made a really interesting comment to me. He just said, I used to watch the All Blacks play, and that'd always be 6 months ahead of everyone else, and that's where the game was going to be around the world in 6 months' time. But he felt that they were the team that were playing a bit of catch up, and I think he was bang on with those comments. I mean, there's no doubt that COVID had an impact in terms of that as well. And one of the strengths of New Zealand rugby is their ability to change and change quickly, you know, in a crisis, and they will make pretty swift changes in terms of looking at themselves and the way that they play. So it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next 12 months, but they're much more receptive to what's actually happening in the game outside of New Zealand. Because I kind of felt when I came back that, you know, the five super rugby teams are almost like clones of each other. Everyone did exactly the same. Everyone defended the same way that Aaron Smith defended, all the nines defended like him. They all had the same patterns and setups and structures. But now everyone's starting to be a little bit more open and think a bit more outwardly, which I think is, you know, really, really positive.
It was very interesting to see your old sparring partner, Joe Schmidt, in a tracksuit in the coaching box for the second Bledisloe. Obviously, when we talk a lot about the New Zealand system, which all feeds up into the All Blacks, do you talk to Ian Foster at all? Do you talk to anyone at the NZRU? What's your sort of communication and dialogue like with all things All Blacks?
Yeah, and I've spoken to Fozzie on a couple of occasions. I did text him. Obviously, I've never, in all of my time at rugby, I've never seen a coach under that sort of pressure, that sort of criticism that he faced. And I sent him a text just saying, "Look, mate, I know things are pretty tough at the moment. I hope you're doing okay." And couple of days later, he sort of texts back to me. He's just saying, you know, I know you told me how tough it was at this level. I probably should have listened to you a bit more. So he was making a bit of a joke about it. But, you know, it's quite, you know, they've obviously been through some tough times, but they've won the championship. And I think they'll look at building on, you know, for the next 12 months. So really, really looking forward to the autumn matches. I think they're going to be, you know, really, you know, pretty exciting.
Yeah, so you talked about kind of having a bit of mongrel and obviously a coach losing his rag. Do you think, did Ian Foster need to lose his rag a bit more? Because he's quite positive in some of those press conferences, but is he the kind of bloke to lose his head? Because I know you would have done.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure that's in his makeup. You know, that's, and maybe there's other people within that coaching environment who are, you know, capable of doing that. You know, that's, you know, if it wasn't me losing my head, it would have been Sean Edwards. You know,
you had to lose your head to stop Sean filling everyone in. It was like less than two evils, isn't it? Christ, Sean. Sean's going to go mad, right? I better go mad. Do you want the All Blacks job? Is that something you'd be interested in?
Like I said, I've had the opportunities that things have come up because, you know, I've been lucky enough, if I've been successful and with teams, then you get opportunities. And that's, I'm not looking at the All Blacks and saying, oh, I want to be the All Black coach. But if you're doing something and you're successful, then those opportunities come up in the future. I haven't planned and not planning long term. And I don't think about jobs in the future. You know, what will be.
You know, every politician.
There's a lot of spluttering and stuttering going on there. That we couldn't find the page of the media handbook fast enough.
You know, every politician that's ever gone who turns around and says, I'm completely not interested in the position, means they're absolutely interested in the position. What you should say, Gats, is, yeah, I fucking want it. Ian Foster wants to watch his back, then you definitely won't get it. But if you turn around and say, I haven't really thought about it, you know, I'm just in for the love of the game.
Look, you can't deny what Scott Robinson's done with the Crusaders. There was a lot of speculation that, you know, with those losses, whether they were going to, you know, whether Fozzie would have lost his job, and I think they had, I think they had Scott Robinson lined up with some other people if they had lost that second test to South Africa. You know, that's the word. I'm not 100% sure about that, but pretty confident that was what was potentially going to happen. And he's been incredibly successful what he's done with the Crusaders, and you know, I think that he's, you know, potentially the guy that they'll be lining up for the future.
Can I ask you a question about the dashboard of buttons that international rugby presents you? And you were always very, very good at just playing little mind games. And I've just jotted down a couple here. So I remember you going after Dylan Hartley before an England-Wales game. Obviously, Razzy Erasmus, who produced a DVD for all rugby fans last summer. I remember you saying to Eddie Jones prior to the World Cup final in 2019 that England, you thought, had played their final in the semi-final. Obviously, we all saw what happened there. I actually, funny enough, it's not just publicly as well, because I can remember doing the Rugby World Cup pool draw in 2019. And I remember being absolutely fascinated that as soon as the draw had been made, you said afterwards, we had a chat, that you'd gone straight to Jamie Joseph seconds afterwards and said,
no, Jamie came to me.
Oh, he came to you. Apologies. But I remember you were telling him how he should plot the pool draw so that it would give Japan the best possible chance. You would just want to explain that, how that conversation materialised.
The conversation materialised, well, two things. One, I got the Dylan Hartley thing completely wrong. I apologised to Dylan afterwards. That was out of order. I was disappointed because one of our players, and a Cardiffer, played Northampton, and I think it was Richie Rees, was accused of eye gouging, and when you look at it, there was nothing in it, and Dylan didn't even react to it. But a complaint was made by Northampton, of which Richie ended up being suspended and wasn't available for the test match. And I thought, you know, Dylan being a hard front row forward, I thought, you know, I was a bit. So I made those comments just to, it was probably a frustration from my point of view, but I went and. In fairness to him, he played exceptionally well that day, and I went after the game and apologised to him. The Jamie Joseph one was interesting because he came to me and said, if it was you, because they had Ireland and Scotland in their pull for the World Cup. He said, who would you play first? Would you play Ireland or Scotland? And at the game, and I said, I wouldn't play either of them. And he looked at me and he said, what? I said, I'd make them play each other first. And he said, why is that? He said, because whoever loses that is now shitting themselves, because if they lose one more game, they're not going to make the quarterfinals. So that's what happened. If you remember, Ireland and Scotland played, and Ireland won that, and then Japan went on to make the quarterfinals. And England made the same mistake in 2015, because they should have made us play Australia first, and they didn't do that. And as a result, England ended up missing out, you know.
I love the mind games and the insight.
What's another mistake in 2015 to add to the laundry list of other ones? I don't even that came out in the bloody. That, I mean, that's, you know, what an astute mind.
I didn't even know you got to pick.
Yeah, you can build the pool. There you go. But yeah, those mind games.
If you're the home team,
you can put together those mind games. Was that something that you just loved? I mean, were they mind games? I don't know. But was that something you loved? Was it something you needed? Was it something you felt you had to do? Because the reason I asked the question, and we've spoken to Eddie Jones about this in the past, is that rugby needs people. We call it the Sky Sports News Test, who, when they come on, you stop to listen, you turn up the volume to hear what they've got to say. And rugby needs more of those characters. You were one of those people who, when you spoke, it made headlines on the back page, which is what the game needs right now. Was that something you were conscious of, or was it just something you quite enjoyed doing because as a five-year-old you were competitive?
A little bit conscious of it, but Alex, to be honest, I mean, sometimes it was just, I kind of pride myself on not trying to play games in a strange way, that if I get asked a question, I'll give you an opinion or I'll give you an honest answer. And then that way I don't have to think in the future, you know, what I've said if I get asked the same question, because I know that I've, you know, given you an honest answer. And so sometimes if I've given an opinion or given an honest answer, it was then turned into, you know, made a either controversy or someone made a massive headline out of it. And it wasn't me trying to, you know, throw grenades in there. It was just me being who I am. And on the other side there, I know there were times when I did lob a little grenade in there that you knew it was going to rile someone up in there. And often was as much about being happy about putting the pressure on yourself and taking the pressure off the team and the expectations, because, you know, there are a lot of expectations of Wales in terms of wanting to be successful. And, you know, if you can create a little bit of it between yourself and someone else, then, you know, that can alleviate a little bit of pressure. But often you wouldn't always know the context. So you might get asked in a press conference, oh, what Warren, what do you think about what Eddie Jones said about such and such? So then you might rile up and react to it, but then you go back and you say, oh, you know, he's made that comment in a different way, in a different context, but the question's been put to you by the way it's been put to you by the journalist or whatever. You know, he knows that he can potentially get a reaction out of you. So he asked me something, I'll give you an opinion. I'm not always right, but that's the way I see things. And then, yeah, there have been other times when, like I said, I have lobbed a little grenade in there that, you know, is potentially going to get a reaction.
Which, with hindsight, was the most effective in getting you what you wanted?
Possibly on a couple of occasions, where if you've been a little bit critical of the way that they may have played, if they've been seen as being a little bit negative. Like I said, you know,
the Ireland game.
Yeah, I started this. I mean, I think it was 2014 or 2:13 or 2:14, I can't remember. We'd played Ireland in Dublin, and they played incredibly well against us. The kicking was excellent. They beat us up front physically, and really dominated and won by about 20 points. And I was concerned they were going to play the same way the next year against us. And so I came out and, you know, a bit critical of Ireland, saying that they were, you know, they kicked a lot. All the play was off nine. They were pretty boring in the way that they played. And apparently I got a reaction from Joe Smith. They came out and played some rugby against us and we won the game. So, yeah, sometimes you get situations like that. But you theme things sometimes, or you say things. And I can remember 2019 before the Six Nations. Alex, I don't know if you were there, and the rugby writers up in London. And they asked me to do a Q&A. And I was being 100% honest. And they said, oh, Warren, how do you think you're going the Six Nations? And I didn't say about winning the Grand Slam. I just said, Our first game's away against France, and if we can beat France and Paris, I think we've got a good chance of, I think we'll win the Six Nations. Later on, they interviewed Johnny Sexton. There's a couple of things here is that I wanted to send a message to my players that if the coach thinks if we can beat France and Paris, then we've got a good chance of winning the Six Nations, then that might have a little bit of a psychological impact on them or do something. And then, but they later on they interviewed Johnny Sexton, and I was sitting at the table and they came up and Johnny was World Rugby Player of the Year and they were giving him an award. And then they said to Johnny, "And Johnny, how do you think you're going in the Six Nations?" He said, "Oh, we're wasting the time talking about the Six Nations. Gats has already said Wales are going to win the Six Nations." And I kind of went, "Wow, job done." Wasn't on purpose, but you know, if that's had one little wee percentage of doubt in his mind or whatever. So we went there. We obviously that game we were 16-0 down at half time, and we've gone on to beat France in Paris, and then we've gone to down to the south of France and Nice. Had the week there as we prepared for the away game against Italy. And we'd taken 31 players with us, so we were trying to replicate what was going to happen in the World Cup in terms of squad. And I made 11 changes. I was criticised for disrespecting Italy by making 11 changes, but I was kind of trying to replicate, you know, I said what was happening in the World Cup with a short turnaround and having to, you know, trust the squad. And we didn't, you know, we hadn't played that well against France, and we, apart from the second half, we were poor against Italy, but came out and got ourselves a win. And then we had 2 weeks before the England game, so we were kind of being written off by the media in terms of the expectation that England were going to come to Cardiff and to beat us. And our whole theming for that 2 weeks, you know, when they said, you know, was just they have no idea who's coming, they have no idea who's turning up. They don't know. And that was kind of like we just drove that message. England have no idea who's turning up. And we just, the first week, we trained them. We pushed them right to the edge, trained well. And then the second week, we went in with a bit of a pick-and-go mentality to take the English forwards on up front. You know, even though we were down at halftime, I think the last 20 minutes, England couldn't get out of their half. And we just, you know, we dominated the game and physically. I remember Owen Farrell afterwards coming and saying, he said, I don't think we're fit enough. Sometimes, you know, you've got to have a theme or you've got to drive something. And that was our whole mentality, that they have no idea who's turning up. They've got no idea what's going to confront them when we turn up at the Principality Stadium. And then, you know, we were lucky enough to go and win the Grand Slam and play Ireland in the last game. And Johnny didn't have his greatest game, which is...
From small seeds, mighty oaks do grow. This is the grandmaster at work.
I do find it interesting a lot of the time that I did kind of get the impression, especially under when you were a Welsh coach, that a lot of time that you would, if you would do interviews, it was partly obviously just for the media, but partly, as you said, to motivate the team, because one of the central messages you always kind of talked about was how fit your team was, you know, part of me always felt that you were talking to the players in your squad as well, that you were kind of putting it out there going, look, we're fit. Undoubtedly you would have done the work, but I always think sometimes at kind of international level, the percentage margin of just how fit you could be is potentially sometimes negligible, but actually a lot of time it's mindset, it's going to dark places and then being able to repeat it. And I felt that you always had that. And that was something that you used to hammer with the Welsh team. Was that kind of something you purposely did?
Oh, 100%. And I can remember one campaign, you know, we started off as coaches and we were driving the message, you know, pushing them hard. And we'd say, and they'd be, you know, I'd be saying, there, no one's training hard in this. There's no way that England are going through this pain. Ireland aren't training as hard as us. You know, that'd be one session. The next session, no one's working as hard as us. No one's training as hard as us. No one's going through this pain. No one's hurting as much as us. And, you know, we went on, and I think it was a grand, it might have been, year 2008, and by the end of it, you know, we'd go to training session and the players would go, no one's training harder than us, no one's working harder than us, no one's going through this much pain. And I had no idea. I don't know how hard all the other teams are training. I know we were training hard, but they believed it. And so, like you said, job would be done. And that's, you know, half of it's just getting the mind right, and with the mind's right, you've got a chance.
When you obviously again we're talking about kind of the mind games, but I saw it kind of firsthand, not just with the kind of media, but also you kind of like to look inwards with some of the mind games you'd play between players in the squads. I mean, you know, I remember famously, you know, I've talked about it before with, you know, we used to do something called power endurance on a Tuesday morning before a big day. It would be kind of the forwards would be paired up. They'd start at 6:45 in the morning. A pair would go 7 o'clock, 7:15, et cetera, throughout the morning. And I would always get pitted with Lawrence. You know, I was 18, 19. Lawrence was obviously in kind of his prime. And I could never understand that whenever I came in, why Lawrence was so fired up and giving me side eye. And what we would do is we would do various exercises in the gym. And then we'd come out and do a field session, tug of war, cone drills, footwork, wrestling in the mud, right? And every time we went to wrestle, it was a full-on wrestling match until both of us were like, you know, like dogs are fully out of breath, you know, fucking couldn't even stand up. And I couldn't understand it. And one day he beat me or I beat him and he was like, fuck it, you know, I told you I still got it. And I was like, and we went and he took me for breakfast like I was the good boy I was. And I sat down and said, no, why are you so fucking angry every morning? He goes, well, Gats told me what you fucking said. And I said, what did I say? He goes, Gats told me you told me that I was shit, I was over the hill. And I was like, funny you should say that, because Gats told me you said I was shit and I was never going to make it. And I remember seeing Gats there just like rubbing his hands. But you were partial to that kind of thing, didn't you? Can you remember anywhere else that you kind of sprinkled your little bit of competitive stardust?
I remember I was with Law about a week ago, and he was talking about you and how you're always talking about resting. Actually, it was about the rest process, and you'd said to him that we were tired or something, but he had a massive dinner on that night, and basically he'd gone out and he ended up getting papped at like 4 a.m. and then had to come straight into training. And obviously you'd already seen the paper and you'd sort of leant over to him, how was your night, good rest, feeling better? Actually, yeah, it was a good night, actually, thank Gats. He goes, well, it better be good enough that you have a man of the match performance on the weekend. And Law was like, yeah, I think you're probably right with that, Gats.
Can you remember any other times, Gats, where that kind of stuff's worked, where you've sort of, whether it's Wales or one of the other teams, where you've kind of done a bit of psychology between a couple of players to get the best out of them, or maybe the coaching staff even?
No, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but there's obviously been...
Have you ever won a mind game against Sean Edwards?
No. No, he was brilliant, Sean, in terms of, you know, he's out there as an individual, great as a coach. But he was brilliant in a Welsh setup because, you know, he'd miss a meeting because he'd forgotten about a meeting or a press conference, or he'd wear the wrong kit. And he turned up one day, he'd obviously forgotten his runners, and he had his tracksuit on with his number one black shoes. And not a player said anything. We could hear them all. You could see them all whispering, saying, do you see what Sean's wearing on his feet and stuff? And, but, you know, he was – what I loved about him is that from his experience as a rugby league player, you know, from an early age being a professional, but what he was great at was he was great at communicating to the players about the mistakes that he made as a player, you know, whether he was talking to the referee or giving away stupid penalties or getting too emotional. And he'd often convey those stories of the things that he had done poorly as a professional to try and reiterate a message. So he was brilliant like that. I got a huge amount of time for him. It's great that he's done so well in France, and I hope his French is improving, because it wasn't great to start with, was it?
Can I just clear something out, Gats? I've always wanted to know this, and I forgot to ask this last time. So when we used to play at Adams Park, obviously the coaching staff, you'd be in your area across, but then Sean would sort of have a roving remit where he'd wear his wash top, Steve Collins bomber jacket, a flat cap, a pair of tracksuit bottoms and some bright white trainers, and he'd be operating around the other side of the stadium opposite, and he used to come and sit, my parents had a box at the time, and he'd sit sort of uninvited there, but nobody wanted to say anything because he was so aggressive, you know, I mean, it'd be like that. And he'd have a radio on, but like, right lads, fucking get Oogie on, this is fucking bullshit defense shit, and he'd be screaming and then scribbling in a notebook. Is it true that you once told him that the radio channel's on a different channel and he couldn't understand why nobody was hearing him? Is that true? Because he's going, fucking hell, fucking radio doesn't work. Gats, get fucking Oogie off the field. And he couldn't understand it. He was like banging the radio, but you'd all told him it was channel 10 when actually it was channel 11.
Yeah, that's true.
his team in Europe.
Yeah. He stopped going around the other side then. Yeah. Yeah.
created an extra problem for you that you couldn't send him around there.
Yeah.
You know, you don't. I remember being on the sideline one time and we were playing, I think we were playing Harlequins, and we were down by 6 points, 5 or 6 points, and it was about 10 or 12 minutes to go. And I think Rob Howley was captain of that day, and we had a penalty sort of in front of the posts. He looked over, you know, asking the question about, you know, do they take the 3 points or what do they do? And he looked over to me and I just went, I don't know, you know, you're the captain. So I didn't know what the answer was. But anyway, we kicked to the corner and we ended up scoring and we won the match. But it's kind of an example of not knowing everything about the game. The players are the ones that are out there and they make the decisions, and you know, we all make mistakes. And, you know, hopefully you learn from those experiences.
For all your success with Wales and Lions, etc., was Wasps almost the most fun you've had in rugby? I mean, you weren't quite Wimbledon crazy gang crazy, but you weren't far off, changing in Portaloos in Acton and peddling your way to games, etc. I mean, I'd love to know your recollections of that time, just from a happiness, and also your recollections of the big baby alongside when he first turned up. Bit more hair, plenty of chat, a lot of noise. Did he have the substance from the start?
Yeah, I don't know if James remembers. I mean, I think the first conversation that we had was he'd just come from Wellington College, and I think he'd played about 40 games and played England under 18s as well, England schools, and brought him into the academy and there and had said to James, well, you know, we're talking about the number of games, and I just said, oh, James, you know, we want to put you in the gym and we want to, you know, work on you physically. I think he turned up about 96 kgs. And I said, look, we're only expecting you next year to play 10 or 12 games. And he sort of looked at me and surprised because he played 40 games. But yeah, the thing for us was that we knew he was a good player and we wanted to make sure it was about his physical development. Well, within 12 months, I think he was 108 kgs. And it was all clean, I'm told. But, but
how we laughed.
It was clean because he had that.
He's now rolling at 130 gats. Still clean. Yeah.
He had sat on the bench and been part of the first team squad, you know, as a part of the elite academy that we had running at the time. But I remember looking at thinking about, you know, other people would have taken a different probably approach, and that progression from his physical development might have been 2 or 3 years or 4 years because he would have played more rugby. And we knew we had a quality player and that, but we needed to, for him to be playing, you know, first team rugby and hopefully being able to be selected for England. Then, you know, we had to work on his physical development. And that for me was, I remember, you know, often saying to the players, I mean, my job as coach of Wasps was to do everything that I could, hand in my heart, everything I could to get those players selected for England. And if I wasn't doing that, then I'd be a hypocrite because I wanted to be an All Black. I wanted to be part of the All Blacks. And so that, never ever take on the national team. You support the national team, do whatever it takes to help them and to do whatever it takes to get your players to play at the highest level, and then hopefully it's international rugby. And if they can see that you're trying to do that, you know, that's going to have a real positive influence on the team. And, you know, I was pretty proud of what we'd achieved as a club, but also that the players that had come through from the academies and went on to play for England. And, you know, James is one of those. And 1 year he threatened that he was going to leave and go to play for Saracens for £2,000 more than we were paying him. Saracens were one of the bottom teams. And I remember having a conversation with him saying it would be the worst decision that you ever made over about £2,000, you know. He was trying to get a pay rise. He thought he was better than he was at that stage. But
I tell you what, I do remember. I don't know if you remember this. I don't remember this conversation, but I had my agent actually back in the day was a guy called Jamie Salmon. You played for England and both for New Zealand. And I remember, obviously, as a play, like academy player, you know, I mean, when he says 2,000 more, basically I was just going to get paid 2,000.
Move from work experience to an actual job.
Yeah, from just getting to clean Lawrence's boots and the odd free pair of boots, Saracens would actually pay me. But I remember Gats came in, and obviously Jamie had been negotiating this contract, and I wasn't really aware of it. I was just playing, you know, no point in having a dog and barking. And I remember Gats took me to one side. I was like, Hask, if you want to leave, just fucking leave. You can leave. It's not a problem. And I went, and you know, it was Gatson used to talk to me back in the day then. You know, obviously he's the main man. I was like, well, what do you mean, Gats? He goes, your fucking agent's squabbling over 20p a mile on mileage, you know, or 45p a mileage for doing appearances and stuff. And I was like, oh no, I'm sorry. I want to stay. Literally got home, called my dad. I was like, I, what is going on here? Don't worry about it. Please sign. I think the next day we agreed.
Shook on a hand.
And, yeah, because I also remember again, Gats' ability to kind of also
rally the troops. He said circling the wagons that New Zealand sort of done. I do remember that WASP back in the day created almost such a mob mentality. You talked about the kind of Wimbledon football team, that mob mentality where if you were in it, you were in it. If you were doing anything that was detrimental to it, you were out of it. And I'll never forget one player, I think, wanted to leave, and there was probably 6 weeks left of the season. And Gats just stood up and said, "Look, you know, this guy doesn't want to be here. He's not one who, you know, he's not on board with what we're trying
who
to do."
That?
I can't remember. Well, I do know his name, but it's not relevant now. And he went, "He's not, you know, he's not part of it. He doesn't want to be here. He's not going to. He doesn't want to be, put, you know, part of the mix. We're just not going to let him come back." And everyone was like, "Fucking hell, this is, you know, if you want to be part of it, you're in it." And that was kind of an important mob mentality that you actually kept going, and nobody left. And that was the message, wasn't it, Gats? Really, nobody left WASPs, and if they did, they weren't going to be anything. And you know, that's why when I left after a couple of years after Gats left, I was so nervous about doing it, because nobody left WASP and amounted to anything, genuinely, which was a bit of a bizarre thing. Do you kind of remember that, those days?
You managed to keep that role going well.
Yeah, no, I did. I mean, the hardest thing at the time was that when we were successful was just trying to balance a salary cap. And, you know, we were getting players that were getting offered £30,000 or £40,000 more to go to other clubs, and we were, you know, able to hold on to them. And we remember, you know, just trying to balance the books. And, you know, I promise you, we never cheated on the salary cap, because we didn't have a lot of money and we just had to make ends meet. And I remember Phil Greening one day coming in, and he wasn't prompted by me, and he knew that players were being offered by other clubs, and he said, "Look, I've been at other clubs and been on a lot more money than I am now." And he said, "I promise you now that whatever you're doing, if you come into work and you're not happy," he said, "the money's not worth it." And I think that made quite a significant impact on a number of players who were obviously thinking about, you know, potentially looking at other clubs. And we were able to hold on to them, and which, you know, I said, not many players left. And I remember that, I think that player you're talking about, James, I think had signed for another club. It was about 8 weeks to go, and the following week he was in the gym, and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm just in the gym training." I said, "Well, yeah, but you signed for someone else." I said, "Look, don't come back, but we'll pay you for the rest of the year." So I wasn't, you know, because I wasn't, that was my mentality at the time, you know, whether it was fair or not. You probably couldn't do it that these days, but I wasn't going to have him in there being trained by our trainers, getting himself fit for another club for the following year. If he was going to do it, he had to do it on his own somewhere else. It wasn't going to be at WASP anyway.
This is where I'd normally ask you to do your Schmames Schmaskel abbreviation of it. We'll move on. Warren, I'm absolutely gutted. We're running out of time, and there are so many things I'd love to sort of still, perhaps we can do this again sometime, actually. I'd love to have gone into Connacht and Ireland, etc.
But he's coming on tour.
He is coming on tour.
So if he comes on tour and you buy tickets for his extensive audience with Warren Gatland tour around the UK.
Yeah, Wales.
Wales.
Yeah.
Well, it's around Wales. It's, yeah, Swansea on the 6th of November, Aberystwyth on the 8th of November, and Clendudno on the 14th.
Good on you. Tickets are available via... We'll put the website
not
on
sure.
the show.
Yeah,
exactly. Not sure.
Good.
Not sure.
Glad you got the dates and all the details.
Word of mouth.
We'll do this a little better. We'll put up something on social media and people can click and come buy some tickets. And I know there'll be a lot of people in Wales who would love to come. Just very quickly, actually, we were at the Principality the other day doing some filming. And for all the success that you've given Wales and for all of the amazing moments, they have rewarded you with a gate. I just wondered whether you'd actually have preferred a carriage clock or some golf clubs or something. Are you happy with the Gatlin Gate?
I think a red wine cellar or a cigar
red wine
lounge
cellar,
or the
exactly.
Gatlin bar.
Yeah.
How very kind of them. Are you pleased with the gate?
Yeah. Well, it's the gate with the players. It's the players' entrance. Yeah, the Gatlin Gate. So I think it's something that's different, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, they're going to. Yeah, I don't know. It was kind of a bit of an honour.
It's big and wrought iron, at least.
Yeah, get pulled down at some stage, you know. So they haven't been defaced yet, anyway.
That's very true. So can we just finish with some really sort of like quick fire questions, just to sort of round things up a little bit? If I was to say to you, your best day as a player, would you pick beating the Lions? Would you pick a bit of a log of wood? Would you pick an All Black debut? Which one day would you go back to if you could do it again?
Oh, beating Auckland to win the Ranfurly Shield when they had it for 8 years.
That is a good day. What about as WASP's head coach? Would it be Munster? Would it be a first European Cup, Premiership titles? Which day would it be as a WASP's coach?
yeah, probably Munster and Lansdowne Road. A couple of thousand fans there and a sea of red everywhere. And it was probably one of those games we got too emotional. We'd absolutely battered them in the first half. And we went, you know, finished to Declan Kidney. I think we've got a lot of time for him as a coach. And they hung in there and came back at us at the second half. I mean, we decided to target Ronan Nagara and had some five-man lineups. So we were sending our big forwards at him. And he went off after about 20 minutes, and I was sitting there going, no, he's not supposed to go off. And Jason Holland came on and actually played outstandingly well. And, you know, it was about 10 minutes to go, we were behind, and Lawrence had the boys behind the posts and just said, we're not going to lose this. And we went down the other end, and Trevor Leota scored, and, you know, he won the game. It was a great night. We had a fantastic night. And
I was going to say, were you going to pick the game that reminded you of the night after more than the actual game?
I think there was a couple of Wasp bus trips as well, Gats, that went down quite well in folklore, didn't they?
Yeah.
I actually was a junior reporter for Sky on the day of Wasps Munster, and I can remember turning up, I don't know how we ended up there, in the same nightclub that you were in, and I was 24 and yet to go through puberty, and I went to the bar to buy a round of drinks for the Sky lot, and Trevor Leota was there and turned around and just went, we'll probably have to bleep this, but he just turned around and went, out of my way. And I was like, yes indeed, Mr. Leota, come on through. And that was the end of that. So it was a very good party, and it was well deserved.
He summed
as well.
You up nicely though, isn't it? He did, we say that a lot.
First impressions cut through nicely.
I'll tell you a great story about Trevor. We had these scales in an old cupboard it was an old basketball court we had converted into a gym, and Craig White had the scales in there. And so we'd had this agreement with Trevor. He said we wanted him to play at 122 kgs. So every day he'd stand on the scales and take his weight. And so I was looking at it. I said, Whitey, can I have a look at Trevor's weights over the last 2 weeks and say he was 119 one day, 124 the next, 121, 126, 122, 123. It was just all over the place. So there's weights every day. So I said to Craig White, I said, can you do me a favour tomorrow? Can you weigh Trevor in the scales? And I went, he said, yeah, and he said, let me know, I'll come down and watch. So I went down and watched, and Trevor weighed, and he was 121 kgs. I didn't say anything. And the next day I said to Wally, can you do me a favour? And he said, yes. Can you weigh Trevor again? He said, yeah. He said, why, you weighed him yesterday? I said, yeah, but can you pull the scales out of the cupboard? So he hopped on the scales. He's 128 kgs. So what he'd been doing is every day he'd be going, because you know how wide he was, he'd be going, it was an old cupboard, and he'd be going, he'd been pushing his arms and shoulders up against them like that. So his weight was fluctuating. So I got him in the office and I said, Trevor, we had an agreement that you would be 122 kgs. You're 128 kgs today. I said, go away. Don't come back until you've lost 4 kgs. You're 124 kgs. So anyway, leaves the club. Two weeks later, I hadn't heard from him, so I rang him up. And I said, oh, Trevor, you better come into the club tomorrow. So he comes into the club the next day, and we put him on the scales. He's 133. So talk about me being a motivator. So much of me being a sort of motivating coach, thinking I thought I would have heard his pride, and you'd go away and you'd drop 4 kgs in a week, sort of thing, do a bit of running and watch his food. But no, not Trevor. He was.
There was. I tell you what, there's one as well with Trevor throwing him under the bus, because occasionally we talk about Trevor on the pod, and everyone we talk about here, I always think that no one's ever listening, and eventually everyone always comes back. I get a little message in my inbox, and I'm like, ping, Henry Tuolangi sent you a message. I'm like, shit. Ping, Trevor Leota sent you a message. When we're doing the scales was something, but then they started to do body fat with calipers, you know, the old fashioned calipers. And someone had told Trevor that if he got into an ice bath, obviously ice tightens the skin. So when the nutritionist was coming round, no one could find Trevor. Trevor was up to his neck in an ice bath, and when he got out, obviously the nutritionist looking at him, and he was bright, sort of, you know, red, shaking, and his skin was so taut, they were doing it, and they couldn't get any of his skin. And they're like, fucking hell, Trevor, why are you so cold? And then obviously someone like Whitey came down and was like, Trevor,
We know exactly what you've done. Forget it. Obviously went down, then he looked like a burst beanbag after that. They had to get calipers they were using for an elephant after that. But for any fat kids out there as well, get all fat people, get in the ice bath, then get your body fats done, because it works like a treat.
We'd played in that bath in that 2005 final, and after we'd beaten Toulouse in the Heineken Cup final, and I think Trevor had been on the drink all week. Anyway, I think we'd lost 9 out of our first 11 lineouts.
Yeah, so I was playing for Bath that day. I mean, yeah. we were calling strike moves off Trevor's lineouts.
Well, that's the same thing Stuart Evans had said to Kingy. He goes, Kingy, what's the call? Kingy, turn around. Are you fucking joking? Get up and defend. It was our lineout. So.
Great days of Wasps. What about with Wales? I had some amazing days. Grand Slams, World Cup semi-finals, England obviously in the Rugby World Cup 2015, beating Australia. You can play one again.
Oh, I think the most emotional was the 2015 game against England. Yeah, there was a lot of pressure. I mean, obviously, to get out of that pool was a pool of death with Australia and England in it. I think for me, you know, try not to show a lot of emotion after games, but I've been jumping up and down, and the Prince William had come and had done the jersey presentation before the game, and he'd said something to them. He said, "Oh, you know, boys, you know, can you do me a favour and beat England, because it kept my brother a bit quieter afterwards." So
that was an amazing day.
Yeah,
I think a great photo came out of that.
That is a great photo. I remember that. Yeah, I remember that.
I think for me, it's kind of I looked at my time in Wales about. You know, not always having a huge amount of depth, but what was important was the Six Nations. That's when points were at stake, and you know, probably didn't do as well in the autumn as I would have liked against some of the Southern Hemisphere teams. But you know, I think we had something like a reign there, you know, 75% win record in the Six Nations, so which was pretty good. So that's to me when it mattered.
Last but not least, Lions. You can celebrate again, as you did in Sydney, with 007 or in Windy Wellington, or you can itch a scratch.
Oh, I'd like to have that third test in South Africa over again and Liam Williams to pass the ball, and we'd be 17-3 up and probably win the series. So, yeah, you know, that irks me. I can't really get it. You know, that's the kind of competitive nature. But it was tough, that South Africa. And the rugby wasn't great because they don't allow teams to play any rugby. You know, we went out there trying to be a bit positive, but, you know, you've got to match them in their kicking game and their physicality because of the way that they defend and the pressure they put teams out there, even though they've changed a little bit now. But that performance in Sydney in the third test was pretty rewarding, but yeah, particularly because there was so much, you know, with the O'Driscoll decision leaving him out and pressure that I was coming under and the criticism that was directed towards me. And I can remember, I looked up in the coach's box about 15 minutes to go, and we're sort of 30 points in front. And there was a moment, I swear to God, there was a moment I looked at the camera and I nearly went like this.
The double V. Yeah. Lots of victory.
I swear to God. But, you know, that was a pretty special night for us. And, yeah, I love my time and experience with the Lions. I think it's a, you know, it's unique, and it's the old, the only side that traditionally tours, and you know, we should do everything we can to protect it.
And definitely, so say all of us. Can I just drill into that love for the Lions? Because, you know, we're talking about Wasps, which was obviously some unbelievably happy days, and Wales unbelievably rewarding. But the Lions has given you as much heartbreak as joy. And I'm thinking not only 09, when of course it was, you know, the last kick of the game of the series, 2013, and you mentioned O'Driscoll, 2017. I remember you being on the front page of one of the newspapers in New Zealand, mocked up as a clown, etc. I mean, is it a genuine love? Have you enjoyed going to that level and the pressure that comes with it, or actually at times has it got out of hand?
Oh, it's definitely got out of hand. It's been a challenge. And the New Zealand one, I have no doubt the criticism, you know, from day one towards me was to try and unsettle me, and I have no doubt it came from the All Black coaches as part of their strategy to really try and do that. Absolutely convinced about that. And people I know have, you know, have confirmed that. And that's
have you ever discussed that with the individuals involved, with Steve Hansen?
No, I haven't. No.
Would you? No. If you could?
I probably would have a conversation with them. Yeah, I think the Lions has got now where it's become so important for the Southern Hemisphere teams to win, and it's almost like win at all costs. And I have a different kind of a slightly different attitude with the Lions. I think the Lions should be a celebration of rugby, and the fans and the enjoyment, and they're as important. The Lions fans are important as the rugby and the games, and you know, let the rugby just do the talking, and we should forget about all the other stuff that we've seen. And so that's some of that media stuff in 2017 was really disappointing. You know, what happened in South Africa with, you know, that video that was sent out and a few other bits and pieces, you know, it just showed to me that, you know, the Southern Hemisphere teams at the moment, you know, they're putting so much emphasis on how important it is to win a Lions series. But like I said, it should be that celebration of the game and take some of the politics out of it, or some of the stuff that we're seeing probably in the last couple of tours.
Is that door still open? Has it been locked and well and truly the key thrown away, or is it just a little cat flap of opportunity with, I suppose, Australia in 2025?
Oh, no, I think it's time for someone else to... If you're going to pick a Lions coach at the moment, there's only one choice, isn't there?
And you would go with Andy Farrell?
Well, I think it's the choice, isn't it? It all depends on what happens next year in the World Cup. The way that the draw of the World Cup is, the great potential that the All Blacks and Ireland are going to meet in the quarterfinals. And so Ireland might, you know, have heartbreak again and not get past the quarterfinals. That's what they want to try and do, which then, you know, what's a knock-on effect on that in terms of the Six Nations. So, like, they've done incredibly well by winning a series in New Zealand, but you've got to be successful over the next year or so. And if you are successful, you know, you put your hand up and you've got a chance of being maybe nominated and picked as the next Lions coach. But at the moment, I think Andy's, you know, definitely the front runner.
Very interesting. It has been an absolute privilege to have you on. We will do a far better job of promoting your tour in Wales. Tickets are available now if you Google Gatland Tour. Do you know, actually, funny enough, Warren, the last thing I'd love to ask you about just before we go, because we haven't marked this really, but was the unbelievably sad passing of Eddie Butler. And I don't know, I presume you would have done a fair amount with him over the years. I'd just love to get your reaction of the voice.
No, I did. BBC contacted me to be a part of the tribute. I think they did Scrum 5 did a show and a tribute to Eddie. Look, he was, I found him fantastic to deal with in terms of, like, you know, that voice that he had, he was, you know, was recognisable anywhere. But, you know, Eddie would turn up and be the best dressed there with the scarf and stuff. But, you know, as a journalist and an interviewer, he had empathy and stuff, but was always capable of asking the hard questions as well, and I think that's a sign of a really good journalist. Climbed Kilimanjaro with him, and on the captain's climb in 2012, I think that was 2011. You know, good company. Yeah, really sad, and you know, for Sue and the kids as well. You know, so too young, and I suppose for all of us, there's a message in that, isn't it? You know, about how short life can be, and to make sure that we enjoy, you know, every day, and you know, make sure we make the most of it.
Yeah, beautifully put. And thank you for that. Just a final word. The mastermind, tactician, and just a lot of fun to be had along the way.
Yeah, look, I think there's, you know, there's great characters with our game. And you know, you talk about successful coaches and sort of, then there's Warren Gatland at the top of it. And I think, you know, I said many, many times on record that if it wasn't for him and for Sean and for those early days at Wasps, encouraging me to enjoy the game, to play in a certain way, to toughen me up, but also to give me every opportunity to laugh and smile and show me about the importance of characters within the team, and to show me about professionalism both on and off the field was essential. And I think what Warren's done is amazing. I know he's, you know, whether he plays the old media handbook or not, there's still a fire that burns bright. So hopefully we'll see him, you know, either back in the Premiership or around the world. I wouldn't recommend Japan because they love a three-hour training session, Gats, so you're probably not going to win that one. But I think
they do like cash.
They
as well,
do like cash.
So, you know,
it's a bit of a the scales of life. But I think, look, he's a brilliant man, and I'm very excited I'm very honoured to have worked with him. So let's see what's next for man.
The game is much richer with you heavily involved, Warren. It's been a real privilege to chat. Thank you so much for your time. Enjoy the tour, and we'll hopefully catch up in November. Good on you.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
And there he goes. There are, well, going back to that point that we were making, actually, in conversation with him, there are not many coaches who, every time you speak, you know you're going to get something. But he still remains, even on the other side of the world, in charge of the Chiefs, just someone who you want to listen to.
Yeah, I could see that from you. You were fanboying a little bit, weren't you?
Well, you know, I'm just joining Hask in the queue.
Clearly, because he, you've obviously spent some time with him. I've played against a team with him. Alex has just been on like that perimeter.
Yeah.
That's not allowed in.
He's not really in the inner circle,
that's
is
fine.
He?
But, you know, I therefore speak for everybody else.
You see, that was his first foray into it, where he thought he was on the inner side.
He did, yeah.
I've probably done more with him in the last five, 10 years than you two.
It's not a competition, mate. Relax. I've done more with him. All right, you can have him. Don't worry about it.
All right, cool. Well, we're doing don't really want
better
him.
Things.
I asked you a really intelligent question, and you've managed to descend it into an absolute farce, as per. An absolute master, as we've said, Warren Gatland, terrible at self-promotion. I've managed to find somewhere in our notes what it is that he's doing in November, which is an evening with Warren Gatland. Come and hear 3 decades of knowledge and stories from one of the game's greatest coaches. November the 22nd, as we said, the 6th is in Swansea, the 8th is in Aberystwyth, the 14th is in Llandudno, and the 16th is in Cardiff. Go and get your tickets now. That'll be a really entertaining and enjoyable few hours. A little note from us and from our friends and our sponsors at Honda to tell you about the new Honda HR-V and its beautiful, clean, stylish lines. Some of the tins... I was going to say something that Tins knows all about. I'm not sure the beautiful, clean, stylish lines are necessarily yours. Apparently, it's to do with the hats that you wore when you gained millions of followers.
Oh, I am.
One of the most influential, I use the word millinery influencers in the UK right now, aren't you? Millinery.
Yeah.
Millen influencers.
When I was going to do that, I was told that milliners don't really like it, but they seem to really enjoy it when they get a lot of hits on their website.
Is that right? That's not what Honda were here for. They were here to tell us that sitting in the back seats
they get the best ad reads, Honda.
Sitting in the back seats feels as good as sitting in the front seats, apparently. Don't say anything, Hask. Something Hask now has to consider for his little one. We've managed to pull that back. Don't say anything, Hask. It's got some very clever tech to keep you safe and secure on your journey, something that I attempt to do on a weekly basis, steering you two idiots in the right direction. Honda are very good at listening, as are most of our very patient audience. They've managed to take and make a car that's so human-centric that it's managed to meet all of our wants and needs. Everything you need for everyday life.
Shut up, Hask.
Everything you need for everyday life built from the ground up. Find out more about the all-new Honda HR-V at www.honda.co.uk/HRV-hybrid. Please don't ask for a refund on that advertisement.
I've been really enjoying my Honda motorbike as well.
You have? How are you getting on? You got knee to the gravel yet?
B1000. I tried the other day around the airfield. I'm way off. You know when you think you're leaning really far over and then you actually look down and you're like, oh. Maybe it's a flexibility.
I don't think you should be trying to do that, really. I think you just need to take it easy.
When do you think you're going to be too old for this shenanigans?
Shenanigans.
Well,
never,
I think you're already too old when you describe shit as shenanigans.
I've sort of been treading water because I've been trying to find the bit in my notes which tells us how to get out of this shambles, but I've managed to find the
exit.
Just before we do, I quickly wanted to acknowledge, I had a very nice note from a mate asking that we just acknowledge the very sad passing of Neil Fisher at the age of 43. He was a long-time fan of the show, a big fan of Hask as well, an effervescent scrum half for the Otters and Tring RFC. A lot of nicknames to go, which we can't repeat here, unfortunately, but we obviously send our best to his family and friends after his sad passing at the age of 43. His children, Eric and Emily, and his wife at this very difficult time. So very sorry to hear that news. We will leave it there for this week. Good luck to the Red Roses.
Yes, indeed.
Go forth and conquer. Thank you to Warren G once again. We have been the Good, the Bad and the Rugby. We will be back next week. But this show is produced by the great Shara Kilgallen. The Good, the Bad and the Rugby is a Folding Pocket production. Have a very good week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Good, Yay, The Bad, and The Rugby, Oof, with Alex Payne, James Haskell, and Mike Tyndall. Thanks for listening.